Okay. I'm going to just make a couple quick corrections to Charlie's introduction. One is, the sad news is I have not been able to play tennis because my knee is messed up. But I do ride Icelandic horses still, so that's the good news. And the other thing, Galicia Group, that's the name of the company, not however you pronounced it, and I will just tell you why I'm going to explain it, and that is because it's actually named after my maternal heritage somehow. If you go back all the way to the 12th century, I found this woman whose name was Galicia back in Derbyshire, England, and she was the earliest known female relative I could find on my dad's side. Actually, somebody else found her. And so I thought that was a good name to name my company after. So the Galicia Group is me, the group, and my subcontractors, named after Galicia, this woman who lived long, long ago. So that's kind of a fun thing. I've been doing this Delivery 2.0 talk around several times, and every time I do it, of course, I have to change it because it seems to me that what needs to be said, even if it's just a couple months later, changes every single time I do it. But this time I was really excited to get going on this one because of the name of your conference, By Any Means Necessary. I thought, yeah. Now this is a group who doesn't even need me to come there because they've already got it. You know, I mean, if you've named your ILL conference By Any Means Necessary, then you certainly must know what we need to do. But since most of you don't know anything about me except for, you know, I'm not playing tennis anymore and I'm still riding my horses and my, you know, heritage is from some woman named Galicia, I thought I would start this talk with a little bit more about me as a way to give a historical background to this whole conversation that we're going to have. Because all this stuff with delivery and ILL and what needs to happen or what is happening with libraries, to me it's all about whether there's a future for libraries. And so that's why I feel feel like this is an important conversation to keep having in different communities. And the future of libraries is all affected by what's been going on in the world around us. So let's look at some of the things that have been going on around us. We'll start with somewhere around 1959. In 1959, the number one song on my birthday was The Battle of New Orleans by Johnny Horton. Does anybody remember that song? What a horrible song to have for your birthday song, you know? I was so sad. I thought this would be a good way to kind of set the scene. And I found this great website where you look up your birthday and you find out the number one song. Well, if I had just been born a year earlier, the Everly Brothers' All I Have to Do Is Dream was the number one song. Now, come on, that would be way better. A year earlier, it gets even better than that, All Shook Up, Elvis Presley. So anyway, so round about 1959, I was born. In the early days, or in the, you know, not even my youth. Now we're talking now, I'm practically, you know, out of high school or in high school. Actually, I'm past high school. Typewriters. I feel like I can follow technology by typewriters. I remember writing a report when I was in high school on a typewriter using onion skin paper because they erase so good, right? When you screw up, you know, you just pull them out, erase them, put them back in, you have to line it just right. I had this little Blue Brother typewriter, it was the cutest little thing. As I got older, the typewriter changed, but that's the next slide. Back then, we looked up phone numbers in phone books. I mean, I guess you still do that, but you know, I just remember, oh, I know, like if you wanted to go to a restaurant, you would look that up in the phone book too. You know, all sorts of things were in the phone books. All the phones were things that you walked over to, they were attached to a wall. And you talked on them. I realized that the concept of business hours has completely changed now. Back then, you know, there were things were open 9 to 5, except for what was it? Bankers' hours. What was that? Like 9 to 3, I think. 10 to 3. Okay. And then, of course, there were human beings that were tellers, and they were the people that you took your check to, and they gave you money. So then life went on. I started, you know, I had the classic hair style of the 70s. And now my typewriter has moved from my manual typewriter to the IBM Selectric 2 or 3. My favorite one ever was the IBM Selectric 2 correcting. I love that typewriter. I could type 60 words a minute, including correcting. You know, like da-da-da-da-da, for all the mistakes. Back then, my first word processor was WordStar. Anybody remember WordStar? That was a great little program, wasn't it? And then I remember the first time I used WordPerfect. The screen opened up, and there you were, left on this blank page with no instruction. You had no idea what to do. I thought, this is the dumbest program. It's never gonna work. Video computer games started up. We had Pong, the best game ever, which I can't believe, you know, you can't find hardly anywhere. Now it's starting to be available over the internet, but, you know, now everything's, you know, monsters and big men. They look like the football player guys on the, do you guys watch Monday Night Football?
Oh, yes.
What is with that guy, that robot guy football player thing? Is that, do the men here like that? I mean, I can't figure it out. Anyway, email started around this time. We're now in the 80s here. And Netscape, remember all libraries had Netscape as their standard browser. Polaroids, that was a big, big change because instead of actually waiting for photo finishing, I remember taking pictures and you'd take them to the photo finisher and you were just like waiting for a week to get your pictures back to see the great things that you did on your vacation. Now, you know, suddenly you could take the picture and peel them right away and it would, there's your vacation. Faxes came into being, answering machines, ATM machines. My first cell phone was the Motorola 550. Anybody remember that? It was a huge, big brick thing. Now, this was advanced because it was better than a car phone. How about that? Remember? I mean, all this stuff in our lifetime. I mean, I'm 48. All these huge changes have happened, you know. It's just amazing how many changes have happened in that time. This is the latest picture of myself. Or my avatar. Now, the great thing about your avatar is, you know, nobody knows. You can make yourself whatever you want. This isn't actually my avatar, but what, you know, could be. But now things have changed yet again. We've got the Amazoogle Flicks world. We've got Amazon, Google, and Netflix. Email is almost old news at this point. We've got digital photos. You don't even have to peel the photos anymore. They're just right there. From corded phones to cordless phones, we now have got voice over IP phones. How many of you are doing voice over IP in your library at this point? If you're not, this is something to be looking into. Now, instead of email, we're doing texting and Twittering. Anybody know what Twittering is? Twittering is this really interesting thing. And I'll tell you about it because, for me, I found it turned out it has this whole peer pressure thing where you can be left out in this really hurtful way, just like in high school. I mean, I had this whole flashback of high school. At ALA, at Washington, this last ALA, I set up a Twitter account. And what that does is it allows you to send a message either from your cell phone or from a website, just a little short message saying what you're doing. And anyone who cares about you will subscribe to your twits. So you can be following the activities of any number of people, anyone you choose to follow. And depending on how detailed they are, you'll find out all sorts of things that you care about or maybe don't. You know, you could say, at the pub, it's rockin', or leaving my desk to go to the restroom. You know, it just depends on how much detail that person wants to give you. So I you know, made all these people my friends who I was interested in getting to know and who were famous, and their Twitter numbers were easy to follow, and I noticed that some of them subscribed to me too. Now the thing was, I was following all these details about some people, and you know, you start feeling like you're getting to know them and everything, and I'd periodically twit, thinking that they were following me too. And then at one point, I was really trying to find the Lita party. There was like this deal, you know, after the day, and so I kept twitting, "Where's the party? I can't find it." Totally ignored me. And I ended up like feeling that way you feel in high school, you know, like when you're not one of the cool kids. So it's interesting because these technologies, it turns out, can, you know, they can do these great things, but they ultimately have all the same sociological and psychological capabilities of, you know, making you feel alienated. So I untwitted myself, and I haven't twittered since. I am in therapy, but... well, you know, I have only taken the first step, if there it is. Yeah, I realize it's bigger than myself. I did just get an iPhone. Has anyone seen the iPhone? People say the iPhone is potentially the transition mobile device. And I have to agree with, if anyone wants to look at it, you can look at mine after. It makes life so much easier to use your cell phone. For one thing, you can see the screen. I find that challenging. As you can see, I'm wearing these glasses because I can't see anything. So you can see the screen. It's really transparent. I was just in Denmark. It turned out to be the device that magically could help me dial internationally. I could text to people internationally. It worked way better than my Trio, which supposedly should be a state-of-the-art, you know, device. I watched videos on the plane. I mean, it's really quite a device. So if it's true, then this whole mobile world is going to change really fast as soon as everybody gets, you know, that once they drop the price another couple $100, then everybody will get their iPhone and we'll have even more demands to start making our information available mobily. The point of all this is that the change that has been happening is so huge and so fast just in our lifetimes. And I, you know, maybe there's some of you older than me and I can't even imagine how much the change has been. But for me, it's been just amazingly dramatic, especially when I kind of go back and look into it. So it seems to me that as we're looking at the future of libraries, and that's ultimately what I'm always doing in my work, is trying to look at, is there a place for libraries in the future? So it's actually interesting that this, I just went to this conference in Denmark, and it was supposed to be Future Library Technologies. And what it was kind of this little work tank thing where a bunch of mostly Scandinavian people from libraries and a couple of us Americans were there, and we talked about the future of libraries. And what we had to do was this exercise where they split the group into four groups, and one group had to imagine a future of libraries and books. Another group had to picture a future with libraries and no books. Another group had to imagine no libraries but books. And then the last one, of course, was no libraries, no books. So it was very interesting to have these people like go into a room and really imagine what that future looks like in the context of our profession. Okay, so in every scenario, interestingly, the librarians, which we renamed something else because if there were no libraries, it seemed silly to call them librarians, but the profession remained, but how it looked in society looked very different depending on these three changes. So ultimately, before this conference and as part of that conference, I've become convinced that there are three success factors for libraries. One is that we have to figure out how to deal with this new environment that I've, you know, kind of talked about in terms of how it's changed in the last 48 years and more. Also, the users themselves have changed. I know I suspect all of us have come upon a point in our lives where we start thinking, okay, that's too much for me. Like, how many of you, when I started talking about Twitter, were like going, oh, that is ridiculous. Why would anybody do that? Right? There's always a technology where somebody hits that point, you know, whether it's texting or email or using a computer or Twittering. Like, there's always a point where, because we're getting older, we run out of willingness to, you know, even think that that makes any sense. It's just some stupid kid thing. But, you know, there's these new young people coming up and they've got all sorts of interesting ideas. I also actually believe very strongly in the physical library. So even though I was in the group actually at this conference where I was no libraries, no books, we had to imagine that future, which I found pretty easy to accomplish imagining, but it's not the future that I would like to see. So in talking, you know, my ideal future includes librarians, it includes books, and it includes libraries. But, you know, how we do it depends on being able to accomplish these three things. So I'm going to talk a little bit about these three things still as the backdrop, and then we'll narrow into what we're all, our specialty here, the interlibrary loan and resource sharing. So let's talk about operating effectively in the 2.0 environment. Now, I think I've seen that you guys are all pretty familiar with the 2.0 thing. Does Web 2.0 mean something to everybody? Okay. So the whole Web 2.0 thing came about from this guy, Tim O'Reilly, who works with the, he's a publisher, really, of all these great technology books. And his premise was that the first generation of the web was essentially static, and you go to a website and read content that somebody else contributed. His premise is that as the technology has evolved, a second generation of web interaction has come about, and that premise is that the websites are no longer just static places to look at information, but now they're actually an application platform where things happen and where we can now have interactivity with the users. A really important part of this interactivity with the users is the idea that as the users interact, they contribute content, and we feed that content back through the web, and it all becomes more valuable. So this idea of Web 2.0 is the network is not just static content. It's an application platform that it's continually being updated. The idea that beta is bad, you know, you used to say, oh, we're just beta testing it as if, you know, you shouldn't look at it until it was done. Those days are over. Now everything is constantly in beta. In other words, it's always changing, it's always modifying itself because we're constantly getting feedback. That's two big things. Network as platform, the constantly beta, and the idea that the service always gets better the more people use it. These are all important premises of the Web 2.0 thing. Now, the interesting thing, I think, one of the most interesting things about the 2.0 environment is represented by this graphic. A lot of people have talked about the long tail. How many of you have heard people mention the long tail? Have you wondered what they meant by the long tail? The long tail refers to, this is a graphic of sales volume. The part that's orange there tells us that these are the most popular items. So lots of people want those. I think of that as the Walmart part of the tail. So then you, like, as you go down, fewer and fewer people desire the items down in the tail. But that doesn't mean they're less valuable. It just means that fewer people want them. What has happened with the whole internet thing is that suddenly it is a viable business opportunity to provide people with items from the long tail. So you can make money selling what I think of as those rare nuggets or the odd little things. You know, I can get Invasion of the Body Snatchers from Netflix, because it's worth it for them to hold such a weird little title, because there's enough people in the world who also want Invasion of the Body Snatchers, right? Or actually, the better example is The Blob. Anybody know The Blob? It was one of the scariest. It's like The Blob comes under the door and gets the girls who are having the pajama party. It's a good one. But, you know, not that many people know about The Blob. So I wouldn't be able to get it at Blockbuster, but I can get it from Netflix, because it's taking advantage of what they call the network effects, the ability to provide a service to people to get those little nuggets, because there's so many people you're reaching out to. So where do you think libraries fit on that scale? Who are they serving? Aha! Exactly. They are servicing the body, and they're servicing the long tail. People walk in to the library. What do they see? The popular fiction, the stuff they want to grab, the thing that everybody likes. What's in the stack? Yeah, all those like really important nuggets that, you know, you're weeping as you weed them, right? Because just because they're not circulating more than a few times a year doesn't mean that they're no good. You know, they belong in the library, and, you know, there's this pressure for space. So there's this tension now, because we can service, theoretically, we can service both the long tail and the body well, but we're not really doing either of them very well yet. But I think we can. So here's another thing about what's going on. And that is that we have all these companies out there that are raising expectations and creating competition for libraries in a big way. Now, which of these graphics do you suppose is the library? I'm guessing you figured that out. So I'm going to use this analogy. Just in your mind, picture there's the turtle, which sucks its head in and its neck in, or its legs in. That's one option for the future. The other image I want you to think about as I'm talking is an octopus. So think of an octopus with its tentacles reaching out and going to all these places. So what I'm proposing is the libraries transition from their turtle selves to an octopus. Okay, just as an image to have in the back of your mind. So, but let's talk about some of these companies that have created these high expectations, because I actually think it's useful to find out, A, what the effect they're having on our users and what we can learn from them. FedEx and UPS. Anybody use FedEx and UPS? Yeah, because it's easy, right? It's easy, it's fast, it's not too pricey. I use it all the time. Put stuff in the box, fill out a form. Online I can order a pickup. Amazingly enough, I don't even have to pay the 2-day, and almost always it arrives in a couple days. So the message to the user is that, you know, essentially I can get something from anywhere in the world in a couple days if I want to. Which of course should immediately make you think, okay, I can get something from, you know, the East Coast in the next morning. Why does it take me 5, 6, 7 days to get a book from the library a couple counties away? Right? This is one of the things that's creating pressures for us. So that's FedEx. What about Amazon? One of the things I think we learned from Amazon is that, A, people want to do it themselves because they love going to Amazon, browsing the books, making their own selections, paying for them, getting them delivered, right? Again, they don't have to get off their duff to go to get a book. They can just browse online. The other thing they really like about Amazon is they get help making the selection. And they're getting that help from other people's recommendations. They've got all these ways of, people who read this, read that. That whole recommendations thing has really been a boon for Amazon. So that's something that we can learn, and libraries are starting to learn. How many of you have incorporated those recommender services into your catalogs at this point? Anybody? Yeah?
Some.
Yeah? What library system are you using?
The Sunlight system, the one that's part of GBLC.
And have you found that people really respond positively to that?
I might actually have to ask some of the libraries who are part of Sunlight at the headquarters section. I know that that's part of the simple reusing index.
Okay. Yeah, I mean...
That's less than what Amazon has got, obviously.
Well, and there's lots of ways to start capturing that feedback, and I'm going to talk about catalogs a little bit later, and we'll see the different ways that some of the libraries are starting to capitalize on that lesson, that people like to share ideas and get recommendations. What about Google? I couldn't talk for even an hour without mentioning Google at least once, right? So what do we learn from Google?
More like this.
More like this? Okay. Yeah, that's... Is it Google that does that? I think of Google for a slightly different reason. Anybody else want to make a suggestion about what we learn from Google? The answer is out there. It's kind of like the X-Files, right? The answer is out there. Everybody believes that they can find out everything they need to know through Google. And why is that? Because they don't need to find the best thing. Google doesn't have the librarians who are chasing people out the door saying, wait, I found a better resource. You know, they're just kind of giving them an answer that satisfies them, and, you know, it's a done deal. So that's something that we learn kind of about our users, that they just want to get an answer. It doesn't have to be the best, but just make it easy. Let me do it myself. And I'm happy with that. Netflix. How many of you use Netflix? Isn't Netflix great? If you had to choose Netflix or TiVo, which would you choose? I'd go with TiVo, yeah. But either way, the point is Netflix does a lot of what Amazon does, right? It allows you to find out what other people recommend. It gives you all these great ways to find items. You can look at bestsellers, classic award winners by genre, by director, by actor, by title. You can share your queues with other people. The queuing thing is really important. So I can create a queue of all these movies that I want to see sometime in my life, and I can re-juggle them around. And once I've done that, which is fun in and of itself, right, because you're kind of creating this anticipation for yourself of all these great things you're going to read, but then I don't have to do anything. They just magically come to my door. I can't understand why we don't have that for books, I have to say. I mean, what a great idea to go in there, build your queue of all these great books you want to read, and as you return your books, the next one goes out, and there you have it. You're like circulating without having to do any kind of work at all. I love that idea, the Netflix for books. The BookSwim has picked up on it, and they advertise themselves as Netflix for books, but it costs quite a bit of money, actually, to be a member of this group, BookSwim. But they will do that same thing. You set your queues, and the items come. The important thing is that these companies all learn something that we have to learn, and these are some of the things that I think that we need to learn. One is that everybody wants to do it themselves. Making it too difficult is really a problem. What do you think of the library catalog as a nice, easy, straightforward tool to use? It's even hard for librarians to use. I mean, you know, how do you expect these people out in the normal world to figure it out? People want suggestions. They also want to give suggestions. They want to share, you know, what they know, share with their friends. I believe we also have learned from these companies that people will pay for convenience. Ultimately, it's cheaper. I mean, what did I see? Today, the price of gas was $2.79 a gallon. So to drive to your library and park, let's say that would cost $2 in gas. Does it cost anything to park in most of your areas? But at the very least, not counting the person's time, they've already spent $2 just to get to the library figure. So I think, you know, we have to start thinking of these things in economics. And oftentimes, the time is worth so much more than, you know, a few bucks. So the more convenient it can be, the better. If it's too slow, it's absolutely, you know, no good. I mean, we have to work at the speed that everybody else functions. And again, like the Google thing, it doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be adequate. Now, how many of you call your customers or your patrons customers? Who are the patron people? Who are the customer people? Okay, so this is an anti-customer as library person who comes to the... Well, I'll tell you, this is interesting because I understand the reaction to the word customer, and I'll tell you why I like it. And the reason I like it is because customer is related to customer service. So the idea is not that our customer is someone that we're trying to sell something to. The idea is the customer is someone whose needs we have to meet or desires we have to meet. So not only do we give them what they need, kind of old style, right? But we actually like try to give them what they want. So you're satisfying the customer. You're providing good customer service. So I think if you don't get hooked on the commercial definition of customer, I think it's an okay way to think of it. And when I use the word customer, that's what I have in my mind. So the whole 2.0 phenomenon has extended its way into the library world, and so there's a reference to Library 2.0. There's this woman, Darlene Fichter, I'm not sure how she pronounces her name, did put this graphic up, which is really great, where she shows the equation for Library 2.0. It's books and stuff plus people plus radical trust times participation. So basically, one of the really big concepts in this, when you take that all those 2.0 things and apply it to the library, there's of course that participation thing, that need to get the user involved because they're going to then turn it around and make better quality. Right, they're going to like improve the content that we deliver back to our users, but we have to trust them in that process. We can't get the feedback from the users. We can't get their contributions if we don't trust them to some extent. So the whole thing about we have a blog, but we don't have comments. You know, that's kind of defeating the purpose, because part of the point of having a blog in your on your library website is to get the feedback and to get a discussion going. So Library 2.0, one of the principles is to get those users involved, because that's what's going to make it better. That's what's going to create a whole new thing that you create together. It's also about taking chances. Especially librarians do not like to put something out before it's perfect, right? So this is a huge challenge to the whole culture of the profession. The idea that I could try something, and if I fall flat on my face, okay, well, whatever, we'll modify it and, you know, try it a different way. But the idea is to not sit around and wait for the perfect thing to happen, because by the time you perfect it, the next thing's going to be on its way. So you have to be willing to take risks and try it. The other thing that I think is important about this whole Library 2.0 concept is to exploit technology and outside resources. One of the things that happened when I first started working with libraries, I came out of a technology background in law firms, which is a whole other story. I can just tell you, it's much nicer working with librarians than it was lawyers. I did not go out and become a lawyer just because I was doing technology for lawyers. I did become a librarian, get a degree in librarianship when I started working with, hello? There's something about this culture that everybody wants to do it for themselves. As much as you go to the conferences and you find out how everybody did it, you still then go back and do it all by yourself. Have you noticed that? Like, there's not as much sharing resources or combining. I mean, the electronic resources and, you know, shared catalogs are starting to change that, but there's a lot of things that happen in these little silos of activity, and I think more and more we have to start thinking broader and working with partners, even partners who are outside of the profession, like partnering with UPS or FedEx or the Postal Service. I was just talking to Gladys this morning about their home delivery service, and their delivery is being done by the United States Postal Service. You know, they have kind of this nice little agreement. And I'm doing a home delivery project where I'm hoping to actually get the UPS to partner with us, you know, get them to make a good deal, a flat fee arrangement, so that we can send those products out. But I don't need to have my own internal delivery system, because there's a good chance that I'm not going to be able to do it better than UPS, right? So use those outside resources and exploit technology to do what you want. If this is a graphic put up by David Lee King, who's a blogger at Shawnee and Topeka Library System, and he shows kind of the development of the library from Luddite on the left, I don't know if you can see the whole graphic, to all the different things that happen as you start, you know, kind of moving in this direction of opening your world and being open to these different ways of doing things. And eventually you become, his goal is an iPhone with participation, community, the ability to play, trust, and Web 2.0 as the principles of that environment. So it's a learning curve. It's not that everything that all these changes are something that someone can leap into with both feet and there they have it. But, you know, it's definitely something to start taking baby steps with. The library web presence is a key place for the start of these changes, the whole getting into the Library 2.0, the Web 2.0 stuff. And I'll just say a couple things about it. One is the library, at the website itself now becomes a service outlet. It occurred to me that the library, the physical location, has always been the place where you find the book and you get the book, right? The patron walks in the door, they go to the catalog, they find the book, they walk to the stacks, they get the book. Well, the same thing has to apply now with the website. If I'm using the website to find the book, I should be able to use the website to get the book. So that's a whole simple concept, but there's a lot of technology that comes into play, and we'll talk about that more as we get into the details of the resource sharing stuff. But think of the library as a place to deliver information and encourage community building, those blogs, maybe those blogs or those wikis or something that you're setting up. Maybe they're not just library to patron, library to customer. Maybe they're patron to patron places, book clubs where they're discussing things. You're creating opportunities for people to find each other, just like we do in the physical library. Think of it as a place to work and play. But it's not just the library website. That's why I labeled the slide Library Web Presence, because there's more to the web presence now than the website. You also have to get your stuff out into the world in all these places. How many of you are putting pictures of library activities on Flickr or something like that? Anybody? Yeah? Good. One library is doing it. It's a great way to get people to visually see what's going on in your library and go, wow, look what fun they're having at that library. There was just an article, I think, in the American Journal or something, about a picture really paints a thousand words. I mean, you see a picture on Flickr of these of a puppet show happening and all the kids really having a great time. That's going to say a lot more about your library than, you know, something on your website saying, library puppet show tonight at 3:30. You know, it's got energy behind it. Also getting your library resources out into the world. You're going to hear a lot from the folks at OCLC today. And they're doing great things. Just by being a member of WorldCat, you can leverage what they're doing to get your library resources found on things like Google. So instead of forcing people to come to your website, there's ways now that you can get involved in having your library resources found on other places on the web. And I'll leave that to the OCLC people to talk about. Has anyone been to Second Life yet? What do you think? Any comments?
I don't know.
I think that's one of the places where I go, oh, this is just ridiculous. Why would I want to do that? It's too hard. It's too slow. It's, I'm 48, you know. But, you know, there's a lot of interesting things going on there. And a lot of libraries have a presence there. You can actually, your avatars can talk to little avatar reference librarians and get help. You know, I mean, it's just another place to deliver services to the customers. Of course, MySpace, everybody knows, you know, that's MySpace and I think Facebook even more are these places that people are, you know, hanging out. These kids, that's where they go. They open their web browser, they're at Facebook. So we have to have the library also on Facebook so that we can be linked as friends and they have you in their mind as a resource. I also think the library benefits from making a connection to other ways to get material besides just borrowing. This is Orange County Library's website, and they make it really easy for you to find your item and purchase it if that's what you'd rather do. So instead of being forced to, you know, borrow it if it's available or request it and wait 2 weeks, you can just say, oh, you know, I just want it right now, let me just buy it. They have a service set up that makes it really easy for you to buy the item. So that's a lot of the different things about the web presence. Ultimately, to me, it's this culture clash of the old library and the new library. There's the, I'm standing by with the answers, the guy's it's just sitting there, I know everything, just come ask me, kind of thing. Or the, you know, this snazzy gal who's gonna, I don't know what she's gonna do. But. So we've talked a little bit about the new generation of users, but let's just focus on that for a little bit more. One thing that I think is important to recognize is the principle of least effort. These are a couple. The first guy, George Zipf, humans will always attempt to minimize their efforts. That's an important thing to keep in mind, and I think it's becoming even more so. The more it's easy, the more it's convenient, the more easy and convenient it has to be. Marcia Bates, who's a information professional, she's great. She does a lot of research on information retrieval and information-seeking behavior. She found that not only do people want, does the information have to be easy to find, but they'll even accept stuff that's of poor quality if it's easy to find. So, you know, that's kind of a sad but true fact, but it's an important thing to keep in mind. Ultimately, today's library users remind me of, what's her name?
Veruca
Salt? Is that her name? I want it, and I want it now. If I keep that voice in my head, I remember what services are going to be most useful. Basically, you know, these people are used to having things right there, readily available, and, you know, if it's not, then they're not going to be very satisfied. So users 2.0, if we take this whole concept of, okay, we have a whole new user base out there, here's some characteristics of them. They expect instant gratification. They do believe that acceptable answers are easy to find and easy to get. They don't really have a concept that everything isn't electronic. I mean, ultimately, everything should be able to be digitized and emailed to them, you know. And so when you explain to younger people that that's not necessarily the case, they're going to just not understand that. Everyone's been getting overnight delivery for a long time. That should always be an option. And they don't really expect necessarily to interact with a human, and in a lot of cases, they don't really want to. I always email instead of call. And then the younger people always text instead of email. So it's, you know, it's kind of these preferred methods of interacting. And then they definitely want to do it themselves. So one thing that we're facing is that there's this there's this shift between people who have always loved the library, and I think everybody still loves the library, but that doesn't mean they use it. So there's this interesting study that came out of the ALA, KRC Research did it in 2006, and they found this statistic, which I found really interesting, that 63% of Americans have a library card. They're very proud of it. Look, I have a library card. I must be literate. But that doesn't mean that they go to the library. So I think that that's a big kind of danger flag that we have to be looking at. You know, why aren't they using it? Well, I have a theory, and that is that the people who are using the library are using it because they don't have other options. 90% of users taking out books have incomes between $15,000 and $35,000. Now, my belief is that's because anybody outside of that price range, sorry, I thought I had a little animation there, are probably buying their item from Amazon.com. I can tell you that I'm the perfect example. When I was in library school, I had to write a couple papers at the end of the whole, getting my degree. And so I had all these books that I wanted, and I checked to see where I could get them. And I thought, okay, none of them were available in my local library because they were all really current. One was about data mining, or, you know, one topic was data mining. These weren't books that were just sitting around on the shelves. But I could have gotten them through the library, but I would have had to wait some unknown amount of time, which I couldn't afford to do. So I ordered, you know, like $200 worth of books from Amazon.com to write my library paper. And they still gave me the degree. I didn't tell the story until after I got the degree. Another report I saw recently was a return on investment report from Pennsylvania. And they say that if you are in the prime earning years of your life, you're more likely to access the library online. At least that's how I interpret the data. You can look at the data yourself, but it just shows different people who are using online versus in-person resources at the library based on income. So there's all these ways of looking at that data. This is the proportion of last remote visits versus in-person visits. So basically, all these different ways that you look at it is these people with money are using the library, either not using the library, or if they are, they're using it online, which goes back to that thing. If you, you know, find the item online, you should be able to get it online. Ultimately, people are using, when they ask people why did they choose the library, almost always the most important thing is it was easy and convenient compared to other options. So information could be trusted, not the most important thing. Convenient and easy, that was the most important thing, whether it was online or whether it was in person. These are important things to think about in terms of our users, what they're looking for. Let's talk about the physical spaces for a minute. And again, we're like looking at the challenges for keeping ourselves into the future. Have you ever heard of the library as the third place as a concept? The idea is library is, or the third place is, you know, where do you go when you're not at home, when you're not at work? There's always a third place. Is it the pub? Is it the boys' club? Is it the library? The most logical place in my mind is that yes, it should be the library. But in order for that to be the case, we have to make the library a place that appeals to a whole range of people. I've also looked at some studies or, you know, descriptions of the various generations. There's the millennials, the Gen X, the baby boomers, the traditionalists, and they all have completely different needs when it comes to how using the library. You know, some people want to sit in the nice, quiet places. Some people want to be playing games. Some people want to be socializing. It turns out that the library is hard, it's harder and harder for us to create a library that meets the needs of all these users. Somehow we have to figure out how to make better use of those physical spaces. Not only is, it's hard to have both a gaming environment for the little kids and then a nice quiet place for the baby boomers who want to go and see Oak and sit in big luxurious chairs and have it be quiet. How many of you have what are called click-free zones or something similar? Or is the whole library quiet? Is the whole library loud? Okay. So the one way people are doing this is to say, okay, the library is a vibrant place. There's people talking, socializing, kids are playing games. But if you want quiet, we've created a place like that for you too. And so small spaces are being blocked off and set aside and being made real cozy. I think of the universal symbol for a click-free zone or a quiet place is if you can put a fireplace or a fake fireplace in that room, then it's automatically understood to be this is the quiet place. Also, you know, just making libraries more friendly would be a good idea. Making it easy to walk in, get your book, check it out, and run out the door in 2 seconds for the people that just want to run in and run out. But for the people that want to browse, make the signs easy for them to understand. You know, not everybody knows that the items that they like best are in 80211. You know, what is that anyway? Anybody know what the 800s are?
Literature.
Good guess.
That's C30. No, I'm sure that's a network.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's funny. Yeah. I meant the Dewey number, yeah. I could go on and on about the benefits of storing infrequently used items remotely, but I'll just semi-go on. There's some in the academic world, they use compact shelving with automated retrieval systems. I don't know of a single public library that does this yet. Maybe Chicago Public Library. But this is a really great idea, I think, because it creates ways to open up the physical library space for people instead of books. You know, this whole idea that books are the brand, I'm not sure that does us any good because, you know, books are only a small piece of the information puzzle. But the library space, if we want people to keep coming to the library, has to be more versatile. And one way to do that is to get some of the books out without throwing them away. And so I really like the idea of putting them in compact systems off-site. And I know you're saying, oh my God, there's no way we could do such a thing. It'd be so terribly expensive. But in fact, if you're building a new library, compact storage space, even with the automated retrieval system, is cheaper. This, just using the University of Utah as an example, to build the same cost or the same storage for a book in a public space versus an off-site, a non-public space, $20 per item it costs to store a book on a shelf in a public space versus $4 per item to store it in a remote storage with an automated retrieval system. But not only that, compact shelving with an automated retrieval system is faster. There was some academic library that found out that their student customers or student patrons or users, whatever you want to call them, were actually spending like 20 minutes and in some cases 30 minutes to find the item in the stacks. Now, I know that could be, you know, there's lots of explanations for that, but the idea that you can actually go to the interface, find your item, request it, and pick it up in 5 minutes, that has a lot of appeal. And the fact that it's cheaper and it makes your space more versatile, I don't know, it starts to add up in my mind. So. The other thing is to get beyond thinking of library outlets as only the library. A lot of libraries are starting to do things like put information kiosks in places out in the community where people are. I was just at this Denmark meeting, was with a guy who's selling a book dispenser. Actually, I think there's a graphic of one type. This Boca Maten is one type of book dispenser. It has some huge number of books available in the background. I think 2,000 CDs and DVDs you can get through this book dispenser. But the one I really liked was actually more like a candy machine, you know, where you stand up there and you look in the screen and you can see all the books sitting there. And you push the button for the one you want. And I don't think you actually have to pull the thing. But, you know, the book drops down and you get your book, and, you know, all with your library card. 60 books can be on display in this thing, and 3,600 books are stored in the unit. So imagine, you know, adding availability of 3,600 mostly popular items somewhere in a community. It's a lot cheaper than a branch. It doesn't have to be staffed. And it also turns into a book return place because they also have a book return slot in that same unit. So there's some pretty creative things that you can do. And that concludes my discussion of the three critical success factors. So what I want to do now, and some suggestions for how we ensure that we have libraries into the future. So we've talked about the 2.0 environment, we've talked about libraries and users. What I want to do is now narrow in a little bit on resource sharing or interlibrary loan. And I have good news and bad news. The bad news is the good news is there's lots of room for improvement. The bad news is there's a lot of things going wrong right now. And I think of it as springing all these leaks. There's all these ways that the users kind of squirt out of the system, and we have to find a way to close up all these places where we're losing our users. Here's all the things we're doing wrong. We make them work way too hard to find anything, those horrible catalog interfaces. Some of them are getting better, but it's still too hard to find stuff. We're making them wait too long to get stuff. And we're not giving them anywhere near the number of choices that they expect in this day and age. And that whole thing about the people that are using the libraries are from this one, you know, kind of population potentially. I want to see how we can offer services to the people who are not even using the library at all at this point. So here's my model of the leakage points. And I just want to talk about these three particular places. Is first of all, we have to make sure that people choose the library. So before you can do an interlibrary loan transaction, they have to come to you. They have to think to use you, right? And right now they're not necessarily doing that, or less and less they will be doing that. Some of the ways, we'll talk about some of the ways that we can increase that. Also, we have to do better at helping them find it, because if they can't find it in a library resource, they're going to go somewhere else to do the finding. So even if they think of you, if you fail to help them find it, they squirt out. Then if they choose you, they find it, and then you can't get it for them, guess what? They squirt out again. So we have to plug up those leaks. So I pose this this next little bit in the form of challenges. Challenge one, choosing the library. How do we get the library to choose the library instead of one of the competitors? Here's some ideas. Go out to where the user is. Social networking sites, MySpace, Facebook, LinkedIn, Flickr, Delicious, these are all places that we can have a library presence. That, you know, we don't just make the library website be this fabulous entity. We actually become that octopus now, where we say, okay, here's a place that users are. Here's a place that we can provide services or make them, you know, think about services. In MySpace, lots of libraries are actually having a link on their MySpace profile to the library catalog, so kids can inside Facebook and MySpace, they can search the library catalog. They don't have to go to the library catalog themselves. Blogs, of course, are a great way to reach out and to create communities. How many of you are doing virtual reference of some kind? Excellent. Anyone doing text reference? I see two. Excellent. So I was really intrigued by the idea of using text reference, which is essentially getting reference service through your phone, texting. There was a study that somebody did, and I don't remember who did the study, but they found that a lot of the athletes really benefited, like their grades went up when they could use reference via texting, because they're busy, you know, doing their sports thing, they're traveling, they're in other cities, they're at practices at the times that the library is open. But as soon as suddenly a professional that could help them was available at times that they could get to them and get to them remotely, they started using that reference service. So I think that's a really perfect example of the ways that we can go to the user. This whole idea of exposing library resources refers to the idea of getting catalog records out to where people are going to bump into them. WorldCat is doing a really good job with that, creating interfaces with Google so that, you know, when you search Google, you can find out items that are in the library, and Gail's going to talk more about the fabulous work that's being done there. RSS feeds are a great way to get things out into the world. Creating these RSS feeds, does everybody know what an RSS feed is?
No.
Okay, let's talk about RSS feeds then. RSS feeds are, if you think about it as a way to subscribe to certain kinds of pieces of information. So let's say I go to my library and I only care about new mysteries that are coming out, that they're new acquisitions that they're getting that are mysteries. So I should be able to subscribe to basically a message that will come to me saying, hey, Lori, we just got a new mystery from your favorite mystery writer. You might want to come to the library, or gives me a link. So it's a way for me to define the kind of information I'm interested in and for you to automatically provide it without someone having to sit there and keep track of Lori likes mysteries, you know, so-and-so likes this, so-and-so likes that. This is a software device where you build these kinds of ways to parse out the information about your catalog that people can proactively on their own choose how to get information about that. So RSS feeds are a really great way to get that information out to them and to get the information they want. Subscription databases, the whole thing is changing a lot with subscription databases. There's a belief out there that the model will change pretty soon so that instead of having to buy huge things from EBSCOhost, where we get all these titles and journals and databases, that eventually all the journal articles will be available through something like iTunes, and people can get them one at a time, pay as you go kind of model. But the more we can make those resources intuitive and easy to bump into, again, like I said, the better our chance of our users actually wanting to find us. How many people believe that your database resources are underutilized? I mean, when you think about how much money we spend on those databases, and I didn't get the details of this, but I was just reading an article. The huge numbers of people who have no idea that those journal articles are available at all, much less that they're available online. I mean, it's just, there's a huge disconnect between databases and what a great service they are for people, and people don't know it. And also, another way to expose library resources is to, you know, sell your books on Amazon or some other way to, you know, kind of move them around, keep the, you know, the cycle moving. If you have to weed them, then make them available for sale. Let people know that these are something that came from your library. In order to get people to think about the library, you have to make, you know, as a possible place to get an information request resolved, we have to have them start thinking of the library as a place they would choose. And that means creating those nice places, making it a place that they want to be, making it a place that they think of to get help, good reference service, people who are proactively out there providing those kind of services, and just making them start thinking more about the library. I mean, libraries are so terrible at marketing. You know, why not, you know, toot your horn a little bit? Somebody was telling me, oh, this was somebody in Denmark. She said that they commit themselves to getting the library mentioned in the newspaper at least every week. Can you imagine? Does anybody do something like that for one reason or another?
I have my own newspaper column.
See? Perfect. Perfect.
Get out from the library.
Right. Your own newspaper column is a great idea. You know, they do it with press releases, get events noticed, or, you know, I mean, that's a perfect idea. But make people start thinking about the library. All right, challenge two, making finding easier. How do we make it easier for people to find the things in the library? All right, here's some ideas. I think it's really important that finding is not limited to what's in your physical library. WorldCat is onto something with what they're doing, especially in the WorldCat local. And I think Gail's going to talk about this, but real quickly, I'll just mention what it is. WorldCat Local is essentially an way to use WorldCat as your primary interface for your library, but that allows people to search all of WorldCat but give preference to your items. So the user does a search and isn't going to say, sorry, don't have it, good luck. Or my favorite, meaning it's really not my favorite, is your search yielded zero results, and if you want to try finding it, try our other search engine, which searches our special relationship with this group of libraries, and if that doesn't work, then we've got this other thing that you can try, and you've got people like just chasing their tail trying to find this thing. You know, we have to make the library be the find it place. You go to the library, you find the thing. If it's text, you find it through the library interface. There's no reason that they should have to be going around to all these different websites to find stuff that's in full text out there on the internet. We should all be able to find that through our library interfaces. Right now, we have basically a standard of Z3950, which says, all right, my catalog can ask your catalog. Well, we have to ask more than just your catalog. We have to ask all the open access journals that are on the web. We have to ask, you know, talk to WorldCat. We have to find all these different places that have items, either full text or at least bibliographic entries, so that we can help people find what they need. Search tools that make sense are something that would help people find. There's a lot of things going on with that. Facets are something that are all the rage and really useful thing, and that's let's say I put my search term in there and I then get a whole list of answers that might meet the needs of my search request, but I can now limit it with facets of that. How many of you are familiar with this concept of facets? Okay, so the facets can be broken down by things like genre, by period, by author, by related, you know, and then it's looking kind of at a Dewey number and similar search subject headings. So facets are a great thing because they're taking advantage of all the rich metadata in every bibliographic record, and they're organizing the search results in a way that people can narrow in. But it's much more user-friendly than anything you would see in, you know, a more traditional card catalog. There's a couple, I put examples on the slide there of a couple places you can go and try out a faceted web catalog. But it's quite nice. Anybody know Aqua Browser? Do you like it?
It takes some getting used to.
Yeah, so far I'm not a fan of it, but I think some people, you know, as an alternative, it seems to be a good thing. Aqua Browser is this completely graphical representation of using a search engine. So I always test it with horses because I ride my Icelandic horses, and I always think that's a good challenging search term, Icelandic horses. So if you go to Queen's Library and type in Icelandic horses, I would get something that says Icelandic horses, or I could click over to this line that says horses and find out more about horses, and everything related to horses would be, you know, kind of pulled out from there. So you can actually visually be moving through all these maps of data relationships in a graphical way. It's very interesting. Usually it's dependent on what's in your local catalog, which is where it breaks down. But as soon as we have an Aqua browser based on WorldCat, for example, where all these relationships between all these words is really rich, then I think it will, you know, it potentially could be a great user interface option. There's lots of libraries that are using tags meaning folksonomy, or I can apply my own subject headings even though I'm just Joe off the street, and everybody in the library can just apply their own tags. So instead of being able to find things through the library LC subject headings, I can now use language that makes sense to me, and then I can search other people's tag. That's what this whole tagging bit is about. Reviews. A lot of libraries are now allowing their users to provide reviews of items in their catalog, and you can comment on that. Oh yeah, I read that. It was really great. It was the perfect summer reading, blah, blah, blah. Now, does that make you nervous? Just to think about people writing reviews and having it be part of the catalog? Because that's that radical trust. Remember, if we look back at that equation for Library 2.0, that's where the radical trust comes in, that you have to trust your users to do these things. A couple examples on the slide that you can check. Cover flow is a great concept that debuts with the iPhone, and basically what I like about that is it's this idea, or it's an example of how we can start browsing in digital environments. What the iPhone has done is, if I have all my songs in my iTunes, and I can, all my covers are represented, you know, each song has a title, you know, because we all used to have our records, right, the albums. And we loved browsing through our records, right? Well, what they've done is they've made it so that on my little device, I can flip through the covers and they just kind of go, you know, flip over. Now imagine doing that on the website of the library books. So literally, it's just like going to the stacks and going, yeah, that's interesting, interesting, interesting. Only now I can do it on my little portable device. I can just whip through it and start looking at covers that interest me and that are related to items that I'm interested in. So suddenly, browsing can happen online just like it does in the library or similar. They don't have the smell thing down yet. Challenge three is getting it quick. I shouldn't have done this when I was traveling and suffering from various jet laggy things. I changed the title of this. Make getting it quick and easy to get it. Getting it quick. A little repetitious there, but the point is I want to make it quick and easy to get it. That's what I was trying to say. And this is where we start getting into Delivery 2.0. Delivery 1.0 is defined nicely if you look up the word delivery, and it's the act of conveying or distributing something, or the voluntary transfer of something from one party to another. But the problem is the old concept of delivery assumes a physical item. So what changes when we start talking about Delivery 2.0 is that we are not necessarily only dealing with a physical item. It changes how we deal with a physical item, but now it also includes all these other ways that we can deliver the desired item, because we can do all these things to it. We can copy it, we can digitize it, we can, you know, scan it on demand. We can get some other variation on it. There's a lot of different ways that we can deliver a requested item if we really, like Beth said, get out of that box of thinking that they have to have that one. So I think of Delivery 1.0 as the come and get it approach to delivery, which is, yeah, we've got it right here. Just come on over, come on and get it. You know, and that's just not the way it works these days. So to me, Delivery 2.0, or what I've been talking about in terms of Delivery 2.0, is making it a user-based transaction, doing it the way the user wants it, make it really convenient, make it really easy, giving them choices, and making your service competitive with all the other services they're used to using. Sometimes it means it's not maybe as good as you would like it to be in terms of what you're conveying, but it's good enough for the user. And sometimes, this is the other thing that I think people have a hard time with, it might mean charging for it. So we have to expand, I believe, to the idea that some things we will offer for a fee. Ask.com recently came out with a new ad campaign. Have you seen this? Instant getification. That's what they're saying. I thought, okay, they've been seeing the Get It campaign that OCLC and some of the rethinking resource sharing people are coming up with, which you're going to hear about. And they've stolen our idea once again. Libraries are on the cutting edge, and they've stole our idea and made it an ad campaign. But instant getification. As if Google wasn't fast enough, now Ask.com is even faster and better. Actually, Ask.com uses facets, so if you're still not clear on that facet thing, go to Ask.com. But the point is, we want to make it easy for people to get what they want and not make them understand our process. How many of you, when someone comes in and wants an item, you feel, and it's not readily available, you feel compelled to tell them all the different ways you can get it and how you could do it through interlibrary loan, but that could be an international transaction, it would involve all these other things, or you could get it through one of our partners, and that'd be the fastest way, but we'd have to go through the delivery system, you know. So one thing we need to do is stop talking about all that. And I say that at the same time as I say market our services. So even though I want us to say, look what we did, aren't we great, this is where you get the answer, we still have to kind of not get into that minutia because they don't really care about that. And again, to me, the whole Delivery 2.0 thing is expanding our ways of thinking about getting it. Digitizing it yourself, buying it from Amazon, buying it from a local bookseller and delivering it that way. I like the idea of buying it from Amazon, drop shipping it directly to the user, and when they return it, then have it go through the processing phase where you put in all the labels and things. Libraries are doing it. I'm not making this up. Same with buying it from local bookstores. You don't have to do it in that order, right? Some people are buying it for the customer. I'd like to see a whole e-commerce component where I go to my library website and I get everything, whether I buy it for myself, whether I buy it and then donate it to the library because I just want it right now, but I don't want to keep it. I would have done that with all my data mining books for my paper. You know, think about all these ways that we can make it easier for people to get things quickly. The print it for yourself thing is on its way. How many of you have heard of the espresso book machine? This is a machine that it looks huge in this thing, but supposedly it's the size of a large copier. They had it at New York Public Library, and it's going to go in at New Orleans Public Library and a few other places. This thing can print up a 550-page book a 300-page book in 15 minutes. That's a lot faster than you can get it on interlibrary loan. And it costs $3. Again, cheaper than you would have to charge by far for an interlibrary loan request. So obviously some copyright issues that you have to pay attention to. Not everything could be done this way, but there's a whole lot of things that could. So that's one option. And if you don't want to own it, you can lease it through this company, InstaBookmaker 3. So they will come in and they say that leases are available for as little as $15 a day. I don't know them. This is a company I've never dealt with, but I would certainly be checking into it. So they'll run the service for you. And basically their belief is that if three customers a day use the service, it pays for the leasing costs. They say an average 200-page book will cost about 75 cents to make. I want to just make a pitch for availability as fulfillment. And what I mean by that is the idea that it's okay for items to sit on book carts, delivery vans, any place that is called in transit in the catalog, I don't like it. Because ultimately what it does is it creates more work for everybody. So as soon as the item is not available in my local library, what do? I request it. So while it's flitting around or sitting in the van or sitting on the book cart, I've now created another request that causes the whole thing to happen all over again. And if I had just gotten that item back on the shelf a little bit faster, I could have gotten it for the user right away. So start thinking about, it's not just better to, you know, to get things back on the shelf fast. It's really critical. It's really going to save you an enormous amount of overhead in the long run, the faster you can get that thing on there. I've been doing a lot of work with libraries on evaluating delivery processes, finding ways that we can, you know, cut it down from 3 days to next day. You know, how can we get the delivery services to be more optimized? How can we get things delivered to each library in a way that they can, boom, put them on the shelf right now? This conference that I was just at was put on by a company that does automated sorters, because I've been really finding that these make so much sense, and yet very few people are using them. There's only, you know, I don't know, probably under 100 of them used in libraries in the U.S. Tons of them are used in Europe. I mean, I saw these incredible sorters where they're sorting out, you know, thousands of items a day. And imagine if all of your items that were moving through your local, all your branches, went to one central place, were sorted within the hour out to two bins that then go directly back to your library. And you've already got them checked in. They're already labeled for holds. And all you have to do is scan the bin, and boom, they're no longer in transit. They're being shelved. And you've separated out holds from returns. You can even break them out even finer so that you're sorting things out by department within your library. I mean, there's amazing things you can do with these these sorting systems. They're a few hundred thousand dollars, but my belief is their return on investment happens, you know, in 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, depending on your volume. But they're a great way to do that. How many of you use floating collections? Yay. So floating collections are a good way to not have items do a round trip. So the concept of floating collections is I borrow the book from this library, and I return it to that library because that's more convenient to me. Instead of that turning into this whole transit thing again that makes the item unavailable, it just stays there until the next person requests it, or the next person borrows it and returns it to a different library. So if you can create those relationships with your branches, then you've cut down the whole transit time in half. And some libraries believe that it has the effect of letting the users kind of put things where they should be. And I don't know about that, but I like the idea. Think of the concept of the window of usability. And I read this somewhere, and I love the expression. Essentially, the idea is that there is a period of time where something is useful. And I think of it as, you know, I just have listened to the radio. I heard this great program on NPR, interviewed an author, and I really want that book. Or, in my case, I'm writing my data mining article, and I really have to have that book. Well, if the book isn't going to come to me, and you can't guarantee that it comes to me in a certain amount of time, I'm either A, going to have forgotten about that interview on NPR because I can't remember anything for more than a few days, or my paper is overdue and it's no longer useful. So this whole idea that there's a window of usability has to be kept in mind, and that window of usability is very short for people nowadays. So what I think about when I think about the window of usability is all those hold requests that you put that don't get picked up. Do you suppose that has any connection? Is it just that the customers are lazy and they do stuff that they don't mean to do and they create a lot of work for the librarians? Or is it that it's no longer useful for them because it took too long to get there? I mean, I'm sure it's a combination. So delivery ultimately is the key to fulfillment as I see it. And I like that word, fulfillment. We're fulfilling our users' requests. We're making their dreams come true. So if we can think of fulfilling their requests in all these different ways, I think we move it into more of a user transaction instead of making it be a library-based transaction. In other words, don't make it be the way we do it, but have it be the way they want to do it. I like the idea of delivering stuff in lots of different ways instead of forcing people to pick up holds. Home delivery is a thing that I think everybody should be offering. I love that Orange County offers it, and now Polk County, right? And I'm working with a group in California. We're going to be rolling it out for a fee. Shawnee and Topeka offer it as this default way a person gets any item you put on hold or any item you request automatically goes to home delivery unless you make a special request to pick it up in a library. I like that idea, too. I love the idea of delivering things by personal delivery. Think of all the business users we would have in our library if we actually did, you know, dealt with them the way the lawyers, you know, that I used to work with, they expect everything, boom, just right now, we'll pay whatever, $25, just bring it over right this minute. Why can't we do that? Because we don't want to offer things for fee. But I think we're missing a whole bunch of users. North Carolina State University really does deliver via Segway. This is from their library, which is, don't you love that? The only thing that's wrong with this is that they don't have a big banner behind them. I love that. Brought to you by the library. You know. So real quick, I'm wrapping up here. The future trends, adapt to the users, don't make them adapt to you. Users are always connected, more and more. The younger they get, the more connected they are electronically. Make sure you're connected too. And focus on the result and don't get stuck on being afraid to try new things. Think about this always beta thing. Get out to where the users are. And that means a lot of different things. And prepare for international sharing, which is a whole nother headache that we're going to have to deal with. But as our resources are discoverable on the internet, who's going to discover them? Other international users. I was reading on the plane that 14 of the top 25 U.S. web properties, meaning websites, have more non-U.S. visitors than U.S. visitors. So once the library resources start being discovered in these places, international users are going to want to start getting at them. So keep that in mind. And get ready for a whole new kind of library catalog. I'm not going to go into detail about this, but there's been a lot of talk. Lorcan Dempsey and Karen Calhoun, if you're interested in all the changes that are going on with library catalogs and having them fit in a completely different way, those are people to check out. I won't go into that in any more detail than that, but a lot of changes underway there. Open source library systems are viable now, which they weren't very long ago, but an open source library system means you don't pay, I don't know, ALIF, you said a lot of you are with ALIF. Instead of paying them $200,000 a year, an open source library system would not cost you anything. You would be an active contributor to the creation of the library system. There's a lot of libraries that have started that effort. In other words, they've started the core product. It's called Evergreen. If you go to the Georgia Pines website, you will find a library system that did not have to pay a vendor to use it. They had to contribute to the development of it, and they had to tweak it themselves, but it's not something that costs hundreds of thousands of dollars every year. And there's more underway with that, which I'd be happy to talk to anyone about if they're interested. Rethinking Resource Sharing is a group that Gail's going to talk about that touches on all these things that I've talked about, but it's a group of people all over the United States and beyond who are thinking about all these things and really starting to make some exciting things happen. So again, I'm going to leave that to Gail. In summary, expectations are very, very high, and everything is changing. You are changing whether you think you are or not. You might think that you're just kind of sitting there and the world is flying by, but in fact, we're all changing, and we need to find new ways of connecting to those users and to meeting their expectations. One important thing that I want to just say is, if it all sounds a little overwhelming, the thing that I want to impress on groups like this, the Interlibrary Loan Librarians, is, you know, if you don't make these changes, if you don't address the needs of the users, if you don't make it easier for them to find things, who's going to do it? You know, it's really up to you that, you know, Google's going to try to make a solution, Amazon's going to make a solution, but the point is, if we want to have a future where people are really using library resources and using information professionals, you have to be the ones that get in there and kind of get your fingers dirty and start working on it. So I hope that you will find something that I said today that makes you want to kind of get in and maybe tackle one of these things and make a contribution, because this is really just getting started, and there's lots to be done.